Good morning, Barbados. Welcome to Get Brass Tack Sunday for March 4th. I'm Sanka Price, your moderator for today's program. Ian Cupid Gill is our producer and the first voice you'll hear when you call us this morning at 434-1790. You can also share your thoughts with us via WhatsApp at 266-4862. Or you can email us at brasstackstark@starcomnetwork.net. Today, with the help of the Barbados Bar Association, we will be examining some of the recent laws passed by government and how they can impact your life. We also intend to look at the ongoing challenges with the court system and how this delay in justice has impacted the lives of average Barbadians. Of course, this program is brought to you with the kind compliments of Williams Industries Incorporated.
Now is the time for you to fence your property with galvanized green, white, or brown chain link fencing and our brown band galvanized pole pipes, which are the longest lasting. We will give you a free estimate too on all your fencing materials.
So building supplies, big or small, and Brilliant Metals, we have it all. And Brilliant Metals, we have it all.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
For those now joining the program, this is Sanka Price, and today we'll be focusing on how some of the recent laws passed by government can impact your life. With me in the studio is Kristin Turton, the Bar Association's Honorary Secretary. Good morning, Kristin.
Good morning, Mr. Price.
What is the bar's concern with some of the recent legislation that was passed in the dying days of this parliament?
I wouldn't say that the bar has a concern about all of the legislation. I think we have our primary concern at this time is that we would wish to be contacted and consulted more in relation to legislation, because sometimes there's some considerations that appear to be absent or some things that may have been overlooked. And because of the position in the bar, of the bar, and our role in assisting in terms of the administration of justice, we would have wished to have been contacted so that perhaps we may have been able to alert the persons who would have been drafting the legislation to some of the things that could have been improved upon, particularly in relation to the Police Amendment Act. That one has concerned us significantly because of the impact that it has on the citizens, the fact that 4 of the 10 constitutional rights and privileges of the citizen are affected by that legislation or have the potential to be. And when you are addressing things of such significance, you have to make sure that there is sufficient accountability. You have to make sure that it's actually necessary in the first place. And also you have to make sure that if, for example, there is an abuse of the powers that are granted in relation to that legislation, that there are safeguards for the public and avenues for redress. And to some extent, I don't think that the Act itself makes adequate provision for those things.
But before we go even further into the Act, is it mandatory for government to consult you? I mean, do they have to do this?
No, there's nothing mandatory about it at all. But it is something which ought to be done.
Why?
In the interest of ensuring that legislation is fair, that it is just, that it's in accordance with the Constitution. And yes, we appreciate that, for example, the individuals who draft the legislation are attorneys. But at the same time, there are two heads and three heads better than one. Essentially. And we have an important role to play in the society, and we want to play that role. We want to play that role and assist. For example, the legislation could have been drafted and it could have been absolutely perfect. And when the bar was consulted, we would simply say, well, we consider that the legislation is adequate in its current form and we have no further suggestions or concerns. And that is something which the bar can do if we have no concerns or issues or proposals for amendment.
But and I think what I'm hearing here is that if the Bar Association, what you're saying is if the Bar Association at least is consulted and they can have a chance to go through the legislation, that having given it the green light and say, well, hey, we are comfortable with this, we feel that the citizens' rights are not being impacted in any way, well, then it's basically would be a good fillip for government.
Well, I suppose the government would be happy about that.
Yeah.
But the truth is that the consultation should take place long before anything is revealed to the public anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't know there's necessarily a full advantage to the government. It's just something that makes sure. Yes, there is that.
Mm-hmm.
There's transparency. But for example, the government can alert us to this legislation. We can go through it, share our views, and they can come up with something which all parties agree is fair.
Mm-hmm.
And just, but they don't necessarily have to tell the public that that has been done.
Mm-hmm. And that has happened in the past?
Yes, it has happened in the past. And there have been pieces of legislation that have come to our attention previously during this administration and previous ones, but not on a consistent enough basis.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to be consulted in relation to all legislation. There, as I said, there may be many pieces of legislation that we actually have no improvements to suggest at all. But at least if we're consulted, then the possibility of there being those issues and having them raised exists, and then they can be addressed. And that is all in the best interest of the country. And that's what we as the Bar Association would like.
Great. Let's go to the Police Amendment Act in particular.
Yes.
What you said that there are four of the 10 constitutional rights of citizens could be impacted by this new legislation.
Mm-hmm.
You want to elaborate?
Okay, well, obviously one of the primary ones has to do with the free movement of people. Everyone has a right to their liberty, and that is something which can be significantly impacted upon by this legislation. One of the others, which I think people will be more familiar with, is essentially the right to your property, the sanctity of your home. So you have a right to be protected from unlawful and arbitrary search. And that is something which certainly is, realistically, one of the more likely rights to be affected by this legislation. Because wherever a cordon is established, the police will have this right to search if they believe that an offense, and that's any offense, is being committed by the individual. If, for example, a curfew is established, then any building, structure, home, business in that area where the curfew is set up can be searched once the police have a reasonable suspicion that there is any offense at all. Not even the more serious offenses, any type of offense, they would be in a position to conduct a search in relation to. That goes to things which are as simple as something like a traffic offense. They have a right to search because the act itself says an offense, meaning any offense.
What are your rights as a citizen when you're confronted by a police officer in that type of situation where there's a curfew or a cordon that has been imposed?
Mm-hmm.
What are your rights as a citizen based on the new legislation?
That's the challenge that we have, that the legislation does not really make adequate provision for a citizen to have proper recourse if, for example, a curfew is established and a police officer has decided that he's coming into your home to search it. The only right that it prescribes you with is the right to be present. But what it does is that it doesn't say to you, you have a right to be present. It says that the police, that the individual must be present when the property is being searched. So that the way that it is phrased is actually a little dangerous, because what it does is it almost suggests that the police have the ability to restrain your liberty while they search. And that's a little bit of a concern. That's language that can be adjusted to make it more of a right of the person to be present, as opposed to the fact that they can search and mandate that you be present.
But, you know, some people listening to this would say, if you are not a criminal and if you're not involved in criminal activity,
mm-hmm.
well, then what's the problem here?
Ah, you see,
these lawyers are making a big deal about nothing.
Of course.
The police are there to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
So what can be the problem?
Okay. They are there to protect us. And we accept that the police have a very important role in our society, and they are necessary, and they need to have adequate powers to protect the society. However, the legislation itself is so broad that it captures people who aren't necessarily involved in criminal activity at all. So if a curfew is imposed, it's imposed on an area, a geographical area. Let's say it was a geographical area that contained 10 houses, and 4 of those houses contained persons who are engaged in criminal activity, and six additional houses don't have any persons who are engaged in criminal activity. All 10 of those houses, all of the people living in all of those houses have to be home by a particular time. All of those persons cannot leave after a particular time or until a particular time. And the police make that determination. What is a significant challenge to the legislation itself is that there is no provision in it for the individual circumstances of the people who live in the geographical area to be taken into consideration. So I have a 9-to-5 job, but my neighbor has an 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. job. If the curfew is from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., they can't leave home to go to work. And the police can't give them a pass to allow them to go to work. That's a challenge. And that might be an entirely innocent person in a working class community, but because there's a curfew, they cannot go to work.
Does the law provide, does this suggest amendment provide, and we're just continuing to use your scenario, let's say the person has to have dialysis at the hospital between a certain period, within that curfew hour, that person would still have to be there.
Precisely.
Unless the police give that person special permission.
But there is no provision for there to be special permission. That's the challenge. Now,
so that's left to discretion.
That doesn't exist. In other words, they determine that the area is under curfew for a particular period of time, full stop. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we believe can be amended if it is that a curfew is absolutely necessary. And that's something obviously that has to be determined. If it is absolutely necessary for there to be curfews, then let us make overall provision for those considerations, for the considerations for persons who have places that they must be within the curfew period. That provision can be made. Or, for example, in Trinidad, they had regulations which permitted, for example, the commissioner of police to give passes to individuals for particular periods of time. So you simply needed to indicate, you imagine, to the investigating, to the main officer, the person in charge, that this is someplace that I need to be because of employment or, for example, medical emergency, and they can issue you with a document which authorizes you to leave your home during that time.
Just let me take you back a bit. You were making the point that, if I could ask the question of, if I'm not involved with anything, why worry? Because that's what a lot of people, good Christian-minded people, would say. Mm-hmm. But just using your scenario, there are these 10 houses. Of those 10, four people living in 4 of them are up to no good in some way or the other. Mm-hmm. Since the amendment basically makes it necessary for the person who owns the house or resides in the home, in that particular house, to be present when there's a search.
Yes.
If, for example, one of my bad neighbors conceal something in my yard, for example, and it is found, then immediately I become liable as a Christian person.
Yes, you are at risk as well.
And that's the danger. That's one of the dangers that you all are concerned about. That's what you're basically saying.
Yes, that's a concern as well. That's all very possible because the inference from it being found in your home is that you were responsible for it. Of course, you can say, no, I wasn't. I wasn't responsible for that.
Proof.
I know nothing about that. But the police could believe that they have sufficient evidence to charge you and let that work itself out at court. But they can
do that. What I raise that is because, it is known. I've known from going to court over the years that some young people, what they tend to do is that they hide things in under the palings of older residents. They tend to do that in some districts, and they all go and retrieve it because the old person, they know them as a nice young man growing up in the area. Mm-hmm. They're not really aware of their activities. Mm-hmm. So that is just one. Any other concerns about this particular act that you want to go into?
One of our primary concerns is essentially how it is determined, for example, that a curfew is necessary, or that a special investigation period is necessary. And the fact that it's left essentially to the discretion of the Commissioner of Police, who must get consent from the Attorney General. That is a significant concern because it affects, it leaves too much power in the hands of one or two individuals. And while we believe that the Royal Barbados Police Force has our best interests at heart, and we have heard the Commissioner of Police indicating that it will not be abused, he can only speak for himself. And the importance of legislation is that legislation continues regardless of who's in office. And one of the roles of it is to ensure that the possibility for its abuse is extremely limited, or as limited as it can possibly be. One of the ways to limit that abuse is to make additional persons responsible for making that decision. Because right now, a police officer is entitled to search a home or a car or a person if they obtain a warrant. They go to a justice of the peace who evaluates the situation, and the justice of the peace determines that there is sufficient information based upon which the police should be authorized to conduct that search. Right? That's supposed to be a check and balance where they have to go to a person outside of themselves to make that determination in relation to like one home or one car or one person. And the assumption, of course, is that there is criminal activity. There's specific evidence of criminal activity in relation to that person, that home, that vehicle, etc. That currently exists and is a good safeguard in relation to individuals who are suspected of criminal activity. This legislation is so broad that, as I had explained, it can cover an area where there are people who are engaged in criminal activity and persons who aren't. So there is a significant risk that the people who this legislation is supposed to be protecting in the area might very well also put them at risk of harm. In those circumstances, it cannot be adequate for it to be simply the Commissioner of Police and the Attorney General to make that determination. It would be more reasonable and rational if it was a broader body of individuals who had to make that decision, and it was a unanimous decision that such power needed to be exerted at that time in that particular area. To my mind, it is the type of body that requires persons such as the Chief Justice, a Justice of Appeal, a High Court Judge, the Chief Magistrate, the Attorney General, and even the Leader of the Opposition. And to my mind, while that may be beneficial, it could be the Leader of the Opposition or a person appointed by the Leader of the Opposition. It could be the Dean of the Faculty of Law or a person appointed by that person. And if that group can unanimously come to the decision that it is in the best interest of the country that such force be used, that something so significant be applied in an area to affect persons involved in criminal activity and persons who are not, then we know that it is necessary. We know that there's a greater likelihood that it will be responsibly exercised. And that's something which is absent here. Mm-hmm. It's also a situation where there isn't any provision for the Commissioner of Police to be accountable to anyone or anybody in relation to how it is exercised. What happens is that the person who the Commissioner of Police appoints, the officer, who must be at least at the level of inspector, that person has to prepare a report in relation to how it was exercised. And that report is submitted to the Commissioner of Police. But who is evaluating that report other than the police? Who is evaluating that to make sure that, one, it was actually necessary to take that step in that area, and two, to make sure that it was taken in a way which was reasonable and rational and fair.
So who's policing the police?
Well, that's a consideration as well. And there really should be provision for that. Mm-hmm. Even if we trust our police, there still should be provision for accountability, because where there is actual provision for accountability, there's a greater likelihood that things will be done properly mm-hmm. and fairly. And that's what we want.
And what provision is there in the amendment mm-hmm. That if and citizen thinks that the police would have gone a bit too far, what recourse do they have? That does that citizen have?
The legislation does not
address this.
Address that at all.
So, in other words, when the cordon is, or curfew takes place in your area, and something happens that you do not think was right.
Yes.
As a citizen, you don't think that the police handled you in the proper way, for whatever reason. You have no recourse whatsoever to complain to anybody officially.
Well, not based on this legislation. If a police uses excessive force, or if there really was no basis for them to assume that there was a criminal offense in the first place, then there are options in terms of instituting civil proceedings against the police or the state. But there's also a consideration that when they do that, the person who is responsible is not the person who compensates them. The taxpayers, compensate that individual who would have suffered that wrong. And I don't know that we really want to be in the position of doing that. And I always believe that prevention is certainly better than cure.
If I go into WhatsApp, the first one, is it me or is the bar becoming a pressure group against the government?
It's unfortunate that that's a view that some people take. And I suppose that could happen if members of the public hear us speaking out against certain provisions. But the bar is not a pressure group against the government. The bar has no political agenda whatsoever. The bar has the interests of the public at heart. And if, for example, people have concerns about legislation, we are here to address those concerns and indicate if, for example, we consider that the provision is reasonable and in accordance with the Constitution, or if we believe that based on our interpretation, it is not reasonable and in accordance with the Constitution. In fact, there are a number of pieces of legislation, for example, that we might agree with. Recently, there was an amendment to the road traffic regulations. And provision was made for the criminalization of the use of cellular phones. In principle, we agree that that provision is necessary. We agree that in principle that provision is actually in the interest of the country. And that is something which we do, regardless of which government is in power. What we can say in evaluating it is the extent to which is the penalty too high? Should we look at that? Are there ways that perhaps it can be improved to achieve its goal? That's how we look at legislation, and that's why we comment on things, because we want things to be improved in the best interest of the country, not because we have any agenda against the government, regardless of who that may be.
Mm-hmm. I'll just take one more WhatsApp before we go. We have a number of calls, they're backing up. Since our lawmakers and police are mostly male, and since the people who give birth are always female, has any consideration been given to those people who go into labor during any curfew period? Women give birth every day. You see the question yourself.
Yes, I see.
Interesting question.
That is a very interesting question. And it's in keeping with what we were discussing earlier, that there really isn't that provision for there to be given some authorization for the person to leave in the for the purpose of an emergency. And I would imagine, obviously, that if a person goes into labor during a curfew period, that the police will take reasonable steps to take that person to the hospital or what have you. But we should not have to rely on that.
Again, there should discretion.
Exactly. We shouldn't have to rely on that. There should be specific provision that addresses how that is to take place, right? There should not be a question as to whether they can or not, because it should be provided for. And that's really what we would want.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone lines. Brass Tack Sunday, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Sanka.
Good morning, sir.
How are you doing this morning?
I am well.
All right. I am here this morning in defense of the taxi operators. But before I go into that, since you were speaking just now about defense of the Bar Association, I want to bring something to the forefront before I deal with the taxis. During the 1937 riots, when the riot act was read, this is where discretion of a police officer should come into position. I read about women with hawkers with baskets on the head. Their belly was ripped out with gunshots. A little boy doing the messes was shot down. I just read discretionary powers come from the police officers. So it means, therefore, that not only a law should be inflicted, there should be some part in it where your discretion could be used. That is one. Now, another thing that I hear she's speaking, just so sorry about using the word she.
Ms. Turton.
About looking at the law.
Yes.
Look at the tenders law in government. It tells you they are not committed to the highest nor the lowest bidder. That leaves a gap open that the minister could have to choose anybody that he wants who tenders. Right?
Yes.
That's another one. And I see the Bar Association focusing on that. Now, let me go on to taxes and the things that affect taxes. A law is written that a taxi operator should carry his sign on his car at all times. It's a public service vehicle. He has not had the advantage like a bus where he could take down the sign if he is not working. He don't have a sign he could put up where he say he is out of operation. But if he is seen not having that sign, that taxi operator can be reported in law. That is one of the things that I taught the Bar Association, but they can bring it to their attention. This is one of the things that affect taxis, and nobody seems to understand the consciousness of dealing with operators, because a bus could give you an indication where they're out of service. You see, bus are out of service or private. The taxi don't have that. Now, let me get to the last one that has been implemented pertaining to cell phone. A big taxi operator has the advantage of having a co-worker on the bus, or sometimes they don't have to do that because their tours is already adjusted that they could just go straight to the port or their destination. They don't have to wait on anything. It's already enshrined in their company. A poor taxi operator operates with a telephone, and if he on his way and some person call him for a job, because he uses his cars to inform them of the number to reach them, and he is caught answering the phone, he is subject to be reported. And that is his means of work. You mean the Bar Association and see that the taxi operator's got to use a phone in order to survive? I want to hear the lady from the Bar Association what she think about that.
Well, the difficulty that I suppose we would have is that we are not necessarily aware of the individual requirements and how taxi operators conduct their jobs. But the legislation does actually make some provision for the use of mobile phones while driving. You simply need to have, for example,
Bluetooth technology.
You can have Bluetooth technology or technology which would allow, for example, you to communicate through the use of your radio and so on. And those are things which can be installed. They don't need to be part of the original machinery of the vehicle. Those are things that can be installed. The primary concern that I believe the legislation is trying to address is to reduce the possibility of distractions while driving. And that is, in and of itself, something which is necessary because it protects the public as a whole. And if it is that a taxi operator must use their phone for that purpose, then they can have that particular technology installed in their vehicle by way of a radio. I actually did that myself in relation to my vehicle. It doesn't take that long. As far as I can recall, it's not that expensive, and it's something that's in the best interest of everyone.
But may I add, the Road Traffic Amendment Act, did the Bar Association actually have a chance to review that?
No, I don't recall us having any opportunity to review that
Because I basically, based on my discussions with the president, I got the impression that the Bar did not review that either.
No, the last piece of legislation that we had the opportunity to review would have been the amendments to the Bail Act.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me finish on this. Now you said that the taxi operator could buy a phone or something, some device that they won't be using. And
yes.
You talk about distraction.
You know,
I find it strange that knowledgeable people don't understand the meaning of distraction. Because you could be distracted if you are texting. You're not only distracted, but you take the services of your two hands and control the vehicle. But you can expect a taxi operator driving with tourists in a vehicle. You don't only got to use a phone. You got to talk to people and show them certainly while you're traveling.
Yeah.
I think all these things should be considered. I think.
But isn't it dangerous for a person to be driving with persons in their vehicle and putting the, for example, having the phone to their ear and so on? Isn't that dangerous? You're putting multiple people's lives at risk as you attempt to maneuver between.
How many people you heard that with a taxi operator driving at the speedway is that's what I told you just now. The business people that have the tour buses have a Tourette.
Mm-hmm.
The small man has to do everything in one. He has to survive. You mean that no law at any time can use this questionary powers to look and see what is affecting the small man?
But, sir, the whole point is this. This is one of those pieces of legislation that the Bar Association did not have a chance to look at. That's the first thing. And secondly, what you are saying, and in fact, I'm very happy that you've raised this because it demonstrates the need that when we're bringing these pieces of legislation that can impact the lives of so many people, that there's some level of consultation on it. Now, clearly, if there was that level of consultation on it, somebody in the taxi fraternity would have been able to go to a town hall meeting and been able to say, well, yes, you're bringing this law. Yes, we understand this, but you need to consider A, B, and C so that clearly, when the framers of this legislation went about this, they didn't even have that in mind, have your particular needs as a taxi operator in mind, okay? So, and this is why what you're raising is important. This is why there's a need for consultation on a lot of these matters, all right?
Thank you, Sanka.
All right, my friend. Have a great day.
Yeah,
and we take a second call. This is Brass Sack Sunday. Good morning.
Good morning, Sanka. How you doing, boy?
I'm fine, thank you.
All right, blessings upon you.
And
I heard the lawyer, my lawyer friend there, saying that lawyer is always looking at the interests of the public.
The Bar Association.
The Bar Association.
Yes.
She made that clear. The Bar Association. She didn't say a lawyer.
Lawyers, the Bar Association, yes.
The lawyers are not part of the Bar Association?
Yes, they are, but the mandate of the association is different from the mandate of an individual attorney acting on behalf of their client.
But from my little knowledge, the lawyers are all on the bar. They're not lawyers on the bar?
No, the bar association is made up of attorneys at law, yes.
I see the difference that you're trying to make.
Yes.
But what God means that lawyers continue to do a lot of stupidness, and, you know, we got so many little different angles. You're looking at the laws there now,
mm-hmm.
with how we are how we are presenting laws, how the cabinet is presenting laws, and lawyers continue to do a lot of rubbish in this country, and no one seems to, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
could tackle their interests. You get paid out of business, you get paid out with your funds. Lawyers take your funds, they do as they like with your funds, and we are still saying they're looking at the interests of the public, and they're bigging up themselves. Why small people getting injuries with vehicles?
Mm-hmm.
Homes and money sold, and they keep the money. And we always say lawyers are, rephrase that, bar the sources and looking after the public. Well, help the public in these areas. Let us get some of y'all locked up or something. You laughing, but I'm serious. Get something done.
What,
to get away with a lot of rubbish.
What I can say to you is that persons who have been disciplined quite recently in relation to being taken off of the bar for the types of activities that you're speaking about. So that's the first thing. And the bar has recommended whenever a person engages in that type of activity, an individual who is a client has the opportunity to make a complaint to the disciplinary committee.
Disciplinary committee is
yes.
made up of lawyers.
Yes, but if you will listen.
I'm listening.
The disciplinary committee is extremely well placed to determine what conduct is misconduct according to law. And what conduct justifies that person no longer being on the role of attorneys? The disciplinary committee is not involved in, for example, locking up individuals. Those person, right. All the disciplinary committee can do is make a recommendation that the person be struck off of the role or that they be suspended. And on multiple occasions, the disciplinary committee has made such recommendations. And the Bar Association, whenever those recommendations are being heard by the Court of Appeal, because only the Court of Appeal makes the decision about whether that person should be struck off the roll or if they should be suspended. That is what the Court of Appeal does. And the Bar Association has supported those recommendations repeatedly, because why would it be in our interest to support persons who do things which are not in keeping with what our code of ethics requires?
All right, ma'am, I understand all that.
Okay.
Hear me a little bit before I put down.
Okay.
Lawyers seems to be, to me, mm-hmm. lawyers seem to get rid of a lot of lawlessness in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And you know a lawyer starts from the prime minister right down. There's lawyers tend to be, to me, untouchable in areas that they go and get involved in so many mysteries and all. And I can't see none of them really getting prosecuted for funds that they take away from poor people. You know, you imagine your aunt or your brother got a sale of a house and $400,000 or $500,000 gone down the drain, and the person can hold that money for almost 16 years, and they decide to pay you back $30,000 a month or something. Now we cannot touch them, in my opinion.
But
they are lawyers at the highest authority, from prime minister right down, and it seems mm-hmm. to get away. Notice.
But can we really say they get away?
In my opinion, yes.
But have you seen attorneys get charged?
Only one attorney I have seen disbarred him. He's back on doing this, doing work again. You have a good day, man. Blessings upon you.
Brass Tacks Sunday. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning. You're on the air, sir. Please don't listen to your radio.
Right. Yes. I heard a comment made by the panelist just now indicating that the current legislation that extends the police powers, it provides no remedy for persons who allege that there's been an abuse by the relevant officers. Now, I'm an attorney at law as well.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to say is that although that particular piece of legislation may not have specific remedial provisions,
yes,
no discretion in Barbados is unfettered. And what we have is a bit of legislation known as the Administrative Justice Act, which provides remedies for the public who allege that public officers or public authorities have abused or exceeded their discretion. That bit of legislation is rather comprehensive in the remedies that can be provided, and those remedies include compensation in money.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a new piece of legislation. It's been used in our court quite often and successfully. So it's not quite accurate to say that persons who allege that the police might abuse their powers or might have abused their powers in that with respect to that bit of legislation, they would be without relief.
But who does the investigation to ensure that that people can get some sort of compensation, or, well, as Barbadians say, to make sure people get their rights if they feel that they have been abused by the police in this situation?
Well, like all other claims for relief, the person can seek the counsel of a lawyer. They can go and instruct an attorney, say, well, on such and such and such a date this happened. And the lawyer will advise them based on the law. And then it's a matter of simply filing the action in court.
Forgive me, Ms. Turton is going to come in here now because she's a lawyer like you. But
fair
as a layman, you're telling me you have an amendment that gives me no rights. Basically, that's what the amendment said. And, you know, I mean, I bet a little above the standpipe. So basically what I read there, it tells me I don't have any rights. So you're telling me now the police have exceeded their, in my view, they have come in my house and they have exceeded what they should have done. They treated me and my family badly. Nothing was found, blah, blah, blah. And I feel aggrieved.
Right.
I come to know a lawyer to say, well, look, I want satisfaction. But there's nothing in the amendment that allows for me to get satisfaction. So how is this Administrative Justice Act going to help? Just listen first. Listen and then you can respond. How is this Administrative Justice Act going to help? Who's going to do the investigation, since the police don't have to make a report about anything? Okay, so as far as they're concerned, nothing happened because they don't have to make a report. All right? So it's my word against theirs, my family's word against them. I'm dealing with the practical world here now. How is this going to work?
Okay. First of all, like I said from the beginning, although the amendment may not have specific remedial provisions built into it on the face of it, that does not leave the person without a remedy. The Admin Justice Act is of general application. And when you go to your lawyer, you set out the facts to him. He files and he draws and prepares an affidavit saying that on such and such a date, this is what happened. And then when you serve the documents, it is then the onus is now on the Crown, on behalf of the police, to dispute those claims, and then a judge tries and assesses the evidence. Right? So it's not a matter of so the lawyer doesn't have to go himself and do an investigation. The person comes, they give you a set of facts, and then you prepare your affidavit, file it, and serve it. And then you go from there. So let's not be so hasty and throw our hands up in the air and say, well, look, there's no relief for anybody. Police can do as they like. No, in Barbados, no discretion that has been given to any public officer is unfettered. They are all subject to the review and supervision of the court.
Where's that?
All
the,
of them.
But where's that in this new amendment? You're telling me about things that are not in this amendment.
I'm saying to you again. No, listen here.
I am a layman here now, you know. I'm the man on the street.
I'm explaining to you. Uh-huh. I'm explaining to you there's no need for a provision to be in that bit of legislation itself. The Admin Justice Act, by implication, if you want to use those words, covers all bits of legislation like that. Where public officers have been given discretion to do X or Y or Z, you don't need specific relief in the particular piece of legislation, because the Admin Justice Act covers all those things. The Admin Justice Act empowers the courts in Barbados to supervise every single public authority and public officer in the exercise of their discretion, and any discretion can be questioned, can be supervised by the courts, and they can say, look, what you did on such and such a day, was unlawful, it was illegal, you exceeded your jurisdiction and so forth, and as a result, this person suffered loss, and therefore, this person can be compensated in money and a whole range of other remedies that the Act provides. So you don't need a specific provision in that bit of legislation itself, because a mechanism exists already.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
I understand that, and I actually agree with you. In fact, that's what I indicated, that there may not be recourse in the legislation where discretion is abused, but that there is a right to institute proceedings, and that right includes compensation. The challenge, of course, is that then the person paying the compensation is not the person who exercised the discretion inappropriately. It's the government.
Just listen to what I'm saying first,
so that I can complete what I am saying. I am saying that, yes, there is recourse. And yes, for the abuse of discretion, there is recourse. I accept that. I accept that under the Administrative Justice Act, that exists. And I accept that there's compensation which can be paid, and that can be paid, but really by the government. But what I wish to say as well is that just because there is provision for the abuse of discretion does not mean that that is the only type of provision that should be made in relation to the exercise of powers under this legislation. Imagine that there is a proper exercise of discretion in imposing a curfew, and that searches are done properly. But I live in that area. My house was not searched, but I am subject to a curfew and I cannot leave my home. I'm saying to you that that is something which is an incident, a potential incident of this legislation, and there is no provision for losses that people incur during a curfew when they are in fact innocent parties. There is no provision for them to be compensated, and the Administrative Justice Act will be of no assistance to them. There is no provision for that. What I am saying is, let us say that this legislation is necessary. Let us say that the powers are necessary. If they are, we have to consider the ways in which people can be inconvenienced and their circumstances substantially negatively affected, and make appropriate provision to address that from the outset. Because as it stands right now, if this legislation was made official today. And someone imposed a curfew on the area in which I live and I can't leave home. There might be losses that I incur because I can't leave my home and I have no redress whatsoever. So I understand, yes, the Administrative Justice Act is there and you may say that is adequate. Fine, let us accept that. But there's other provision to be made. And that's all that I am indicating.
What I would say is that I came in on the program when you after you made that point. Yes, the act could have been a little more comprehensive, and perhaps the framers could have given a little more thought. I can see that point. But I'm addressing a situation where when I heard that where, for example, the police came without a warrant or what have you, that's just my illustration, and kicked down people's door and so forth, and the whole run of it, and leave without finding anything.
Yes. Right?
I'm saying there's relief in a situation like that. Certainly.
All right.
But perhaps I can see with you perhaps that maybe the framers could have been a little more
comprehensive in relation to that. Yes.
Perhaps, but sometimes you know, legislation takes a form where you don't always anticipate every single eventuality.
Yeah, but that's where consultation comes in. That's the whole point, and that's the whole point that the Bar Association is making here. But anyhow, now that I have the microphone, I'm just going to read a WhatsApp message that someone sent here. And the person is saying, after listening to this male lawyer talk, it seems to me that we are doomed. First, the police do us as they like, and now he is asking us to pay them, the lawyers, to represent us in a case where we have no recourse. Do they think we are so stupid? How would you like to respond to that?
Come on.
Just reading the WhatsApp, my friend.
Yeah, I know. Of course. But I mean, no, don't, again, all right? Let's not run off and, you know, say the sky is falling and so forth. If we say we are doomed and so forth, and you suggest that your only recourse is to go to a lawyer, and that's not enough, then we ought to shut down the courts. Because that would mean there's no recourse to anyone that's accused of a criminal act, or of anyone that has alleged that they've suffered loss because of some civil wrong or what have you. So I mean, let's step back a bit. Let's divorce ourselves from the emotion and some of the partisan political concerns, and look at the legislation for what it is. And let's hear from the professionals in the area. You know, like my learning friend there, and myself and others. You know, so I agree with you that perhaps a little more time could have been taken by the framers to take a more comprehensive look at some of the possible outcomes, perhaps a little more consultation and what have you. Fine, no problem. But I'm saying we should not throw our hands up in the air and say, well, look, the sky is falling, you know, let's give it up.
I'll call it a spade a spade. You're being really an apologist here because you can't be saying one thing and the next. The fact about it is, as you admitted, there is a level of consultation that should have taken place. All right?
Yes.
And clearly, this is coming out. I have another question here which comes out. I have a question here that comes out too. Good morning. What about a citizen who cannot afford to pay a lawyer? Ms. Turton, would you want to deal with this again?
Well, that is obviously a challenge because there is a substantial amount of work involved in defending someone in a situation like that. And that's why I do believe that prevention is better than cure, and there really should be additional provision in relation to that. However, it should also be noted that there are attorneys who have taken actions like this without payment. There are quite a few attorneys that do pro bono work. And that is also something that should be taken into consideration. But generally, of course, attorneys are operating a business. They have expenses that must be met. And in many cases, what can happen is that your attorney can work with you. They can provide payment plans and so on. Obviously, I can't speak for every single attorney on that point. But there are ways in which it can be done. It's simply a matter of discussing it and seeing what is available.
I see. Let's take another caller. It's now 11:49. You're on Rastak Sunday. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. First thing is, I like comparing attorneys with doctors. Doctors don't get together and create illnesses and then foist those illnesses on the population and say, you got to come to me to cure them. They don't do that. Mm-hmm. And even if they did do that, you have 100, over 200 doctors out there who are paid by taxpayers who are quite prepared to give you the remedy that you need. Why can't the legal profession who actually create these industries and these illnesses and foist them on the population do the same thing? Why aren't taxpayers not paying lawyers to defend taxpayers? We don't have it because, you know, they're being paid already. We don't have to go and find money for them. The position that the guys took on us previous is bang on. Because you guys are making money by creating an environment that forces us to come and seek out your assistance in order to get some remedy for a problem that you created by nature of not having.
So what is your solution,
the consultation.
And what is your solution?
What
laws have to be made, and the law has been made. There's been no consultation. So
guys, that's what I'm saying. You have no consultation, so you're going to force these things on people and force people to go and pay a lawyer to get a remedy. So I need to have 200 lawyers working for the public service who are prepared to offer their services as paid public service to people who need to have who have challenges in this regard. And that would certainly at least ease that particular position. 200 lawyers, no less.
Well,
because anytime you go to a magistrate court, you should have somebody next to you, paid for by taxpayers. And I tell you, the doctors in the public service are better than the ones in the private sector.
Well,
so chances are, we can have some good lawyers working for the public service too.
To be clear, though, there is provision for legal aid. There's a Community Legal Services Act, which allows for attorneys to be paid for specific types of work on behalf of litigants. Now,
saying the same thing, right? You know this, right? We're not saying the same thing. You're going to go down a channel that was tried before, test and found to be wanting. I'm saying pay the lawyers as taxpayers, as public servants, and let them work. That's what I'm saying.
But what is the difference between the two in your mind?
Because you're paying them as consultants. That means the taxpayers got probably pay them even more than they would get as normal paid. When you go to a doctor,
they're assuming
who's a consultant.
Okay.
And that consultant costs a hell of a lot more money for his hourly charges as opposed to somebody who's on staff. So pay the lawyers and keep them on staff. Taxpayers are not going to feel that too much, even though they will be getting a significant amount of a lot more work out of them as opposed to paying them as consultants and legal aid. Because there is another example as to how the legal industry is going to find ways to exploit Barbadians. I mean, and
but
the
fees
it
that
certainly
are,
has to stop.
Are you aware of the range of the fees that are charged on legal aid and how they compare to fees that are charged outside of legal aid?
You know, ma'am, it doesn't really matter.
I'm saying you can't speak to that. You cannot speak to that unless you understand the range of fees. You cannot say that it is more expensive to pay people on a legal aid certificate than it is to pay them as employees simply because you believe so. You don't have any frame of reference.
I have a frame of reference. I used to be an hourly paid person as well to a rate charging.
In what?
Fees. And there's absolutely
in what?
I tell you that. Exactly. Thank you very much.
I'm simply saying that when we speak, we should speak from a position of information. And
information
in the absence of the information,
somebody,
it is difficult for you to just apply a general position to a specific scenario without any real knowledge of the specifics of that scenario. That's what I'm suggesting.
All right, let me get in here. Let's get back on focus. The thing about it is that, and I would pick up here on the legal aid scheme because it's a good point that has been raised here. Legal aid. Now, I remember 2-3 years ago, the legal aid scheme had problems in that the lawyers were not being paid.
That's correct.
Okay. You got
money
problem.
Has to come from somewhere.
Problem.
And whether you hire the lawyers or you pay them through legal aid, somebody has to pay for it.
Exactly. But when you're a salaried employee, you will get paid every month. You will get paid, or the union will come and talk to the government. So you're probably better off going this route as opposed to this legal aid thing, which really only caters to, you know, perhaps the poorest of the poor. It doesn't matter which class I come from. It doesn't matter what work I do. I could always walk into a polyclinic and get service, and I am comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. I really am. Okay. Because, you know, when you go with legal aid, you're saying I can't do that because you think I make it too much money, end of the month, so I'm supposed to go and buy a lawyer. And I do not want to be treated that way. I need to know that if I'm paying taxes and I have a lawyer out there who's also paid from the taxes that I pay, why should you be able to go in there and ask for his advice and get some good response? And that has nothing to do with legal aid. But you know, ma'am, you can argue. Let's go on to my next point, because I know when I talk too long, it's get cut. All right, if you don't mind. The other thing is, when I watch TV and I see all these people search people's homes, so I mean, I may have some weird sex. You know, I like beating up women or chaining them to the bed or something. Okay. I need my life to be private. I want nobody to know what I do inside there. I may have porn on my C drive. When these people come into your homes, just tear out your roof, pull out your tiles, cut out your cushions and every damn thing. Mm-hmm. You know, pull down your pictures and pull out from the back and stuff looking for something that's not there.
Yes.
Even probably carry a porn collection and they'll never even get back. And the problem is, how do you know, say to the government, listen, my man, I ain't doing nothing wrong. I'm going to come and rip up my house.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to pay to get it repaired. Who's going to repair it?
Exactly.
No, you agree with me.
I've been agreeing from the beginning. But
that's what the issue was, and that's what I'm saying is a concern. That is a major concern.
And in fact,
there's no provision in the law. There's no provision in the amendments for that. That's the point she has been making.
And from and what I am proposing, what I'm indicating in relation to that, has nothing to do with you needing to go to an attorney to get compensation. I'm saying there should be a provision for a process which may or may not involve legal representation. For there to be compensation, and that in any event, there should be provision generally, which makes it less likely that persons will incur these types of losses. That is actually what we are proposing. I understand, you know, your original point in relation to we create things to then get paid. But what I'm actually advocating now is something which is in the interest of everyone and which would not necessarily need to involve attorneys. I'm saying provision should be made to reduce the incidences in which people's rights are substantially affected, and provision should be made that in the limited instances in which there are, that there is an avenue for compensation, and that's not in this current legislation.
Somehow I get the impression, man, that we tend to copy other countries. Everything that we do here might have been tried in Trinidad or Jamaica before. We may as well go to Trinidad and get all the laws and bring them to Barbados. Huh? We might as well do that there.
I think that there are some things which have been brought from other countries, but then there are others that haven't. I mean, Jamaica has a similar provision, but they do also have additional safeguards in their legislation.
We're wasting money paying for a private contract lawyer when the law is already done and produced already in Jamaica, tried and tested. Let's bring them here and use it.
The question is the provision overseas effective? Is it working? I'm not sure that there's a reduction
in it.
So no matter what you do, you can't just transplant it.
Level yet, then.
And I cannot speak specifically to what the framers of the Constitution look at, but my understanding is that they do that they are supposed to look at other pieces of legislation throughout the world, throughout the Commonwealth, which can assist them in framing something which is applicable to Barbados and something which takes into consideration what has happened in other countries. Now, I don't know what was done in relation to this specific piece of legislation. All I can point to is what is currently before us and whether that is adequate or not.
All right, sir. Well, thank you. And the discussion that you're listening to, ladies and gentlemen, is brought to you with the kind compliments of the great people at Williams Industries Incorporated.
Get all your lumber needs from us. We have number one treated pine, all different types of plywood, V-joint, siding board, and concrete board. In addition, we have grade 3 2x4s and form ply for boxing.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
And welcome back. You're on Brass Tack Sunday. We're here with Ms. Kristen Turton. She's the Honorary Secretary of the Bar Association. And we're looking at how the recent legislations, a number of pieces of legislation, can impact people's lives. And before we go back to the phone lines, just let's take a WhatsApp. And this goes to the question I asked earlier about dialysis. Mm-hmm. Because when there is a curfew or a cordon, people cannot go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the question about dialysis, and a lady wrote here, How would I be compensated when my spouse dies because he could not get dialysis? Going to court after the fact can't...